Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The world's cities have great potential to drive inclusive, green and sustainable growth. That's the message from UN Chief Antonio Guterres on World Habitat Day, observed on Monday, which focuses this year on resilient urban economies. Mr. Guterres pointed out that the road to sustainable urbanization is rife with challenges, from economic shocks and escalating climate emergencies to widening inequalities. The UN system is mobilized to help cities tackle these crises, the Secretary General said, as he highlighted the importance of local zero-waste initiatives and green spaces to better deal with heat waves. The UN chief stressed that building greater resilience and better protecting vulnerable populations requires far greater investments in sustainable infrastructure, early warning systems, and affordable housing. Local action is vital and global cooperation indispensable, he said. Echoing his call, the UN Economic Commission for Europe, UNECE, brought together close to 50 municipal leaders from the region and beyond at its third Forum of Mayors in Geneva on Monday. A special event focused on women executives highlighted the persistence of gender disparities in municipal leadership. UNECE highlighted that women hold a mere 5% of leadership positions of the world's cities. The UN Migration Agency, IOM, has a new Director General, and it's a woman. Amy Pope of the United States took the helm of the organization and briefed reporters in Geneva on Monday. She spoke of the urgent need to harness the benefits and the promise of migration and to find opportunities for people on the move rather than just treating migration as a problem that needs to be solved.
Ultimately, this isn't about a problem. These are about people, right? When we see people who are getting on a boat to come across the Mediterranean, it means that there have been several opportunities to engage where the international community has failed to stabilize or provide sufficient support for communities who are extremely vulnerable.
The new IOM chief stressed that she intended to prioritize building more regular migration pathways, supporting climate-vulnerable communities as millions are on the move because of global warming, and investing in partnerships with the private sector and civil society. Ms. Pope said that her first trip in her new role will be next Sunday to Addis Ababa to meet with African Union representatives, followed by a visit to Kenya, Somalia, and Djibouti. Over 80% of migration takes place in Africa, she said, and it was important to not only focus on south-to-north migration, but work with communities around the world. In Myanmar, conflict and monsoon floods continue to cause new displacement, civilian casualties, and destruction of civilian properties, worsening the already dire humanitarian situation there, the UN said on Monday. According to the UN's Humanitarian Affairs Coordination Office, OCHA, nearly 2 million people are internally displaced in precarious conditions and require life-saving assistance. More than 63,000 people remain displaced across borders into neighboring countries since the 2021 military takeover. OCHA said that the threat to civilians from explosive ordnance is spreading and that for the first time, anti-personnel landmine casualties have now been recorded in every state and region except the capital, Naypyitaw. At least 1.8 million people have been reached with aid in the first half of the year, but OCHA warned that access and administrative restrictions are causing prolonged delays or postponements of scheduled relief efforts, adding to the suffering of affected and displaced communities. To date, the humanitarian response plan and the flash appeal launched following May's deadly cyclone Moka for a combined amount of $887 million remain critically underfunded at only 28%, OCHA said. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
I want all privately owned radios to be immediately impounded.
Yes,
Log Talk Radio.
Radio Free Kansas.
Well, there is such a place, Toto.
There must be. It's not a place you can get to by a boat or a train. It's far, far away. Behind the moon. Beyond the rain.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have an announcement.
I can no longer sit back and allow the conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Let's talk about
creeping like a communist. It's knocking at our doors, voraciously devouring the way things are today, savagely deflowering the
official story.
Yeah! Radio Free Kansas.
Madness.
Radio Free Kansas.
Madness.
Why should you put your hands, G.I.?
Now, why don't you just take it easy? And please make me a drink of grain alcohol and rainwater and help yourself to whatever you'd like.
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Kansas.
Ear to the ground, voice in the air worldwide.
Well, that's it, boys. I've been redeemed.
Radio Free Kansas.
Done washed away all my sins and transgressions.
You can listen in.
Good afternoon, listeners. Oh man, I mean, it's been 2 weeks. We took a big break. It'll start up again with Tuesday, and this can't be happening on Tuesday here. This is, October 3rd of 2023, and we'll have John Grant in the second hour. Boy, we're going to slow it down a little bit and then speed it up. Here is the latest Counterspin, hosted by Janine Jackson. Then we'll jump into Democracy Now! Headlines, and then some clips, embarrassing programs.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, you can't say elite U.S. news media aren't on the story of the federal indictment of Robert Menendez, Democratic chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, but articles like the New York Times' As Menendez's Star Rose, Fears of Corruption Cast a Persistent Shadow represent media's embrace of a kind of great man of history theme. The story seems to be mostly about the political fortunes of one individual and the huge numbers of less powerful people that have been impacted by those compromised decisions are at best a kind of backdrop. When media try to tighten it, it can get weirder still. That New York Times piece headline included the idea that, quote, "The New Jersey Democrat broke barriers for Latinos, but prosecutors circled for decades before charging him with an explosive new bribery plot," close quote. Come again? If elite media's lesson from the Menendez indictment is that some people over-favor their personal friends and some people like to hoard gold bars, well, that's a storyline that leads nowhere. It calls nothing into question beyond the individual actors themselves. Is that the kind of coverage we need? What does it even have to do with foreign policy? Stephen Zunes is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. His most recent book was co-authored with Jacob Mundy. It's called Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution. It's out now in a revised and updated edition from Syracuse University Press. We will talk with Stephen Zunes about what's at stake in the Menendez indictment, beyond Menendez's political fortunes. But first, a quick look back at some recent press. Listeners may know that the FCC has been ineffectual for some time now because it's been short of full staffing. Big media players torpedoed, with the most scurrilous of means, the nomination of public interest advocate Gigi Sohn. But eventually, Joe Biden's nominee Ana Gomez was sworn in as the fifth commissioner. In the wake of that, FCC Chair Jessica Rosenworcel has now announced that the agency is going to be an active player again. At the National Press Club this week, Rosenworcel said that the FCC will vote on a notice of proposed rulemaking at its next meeting coming up in mid-October, and they're going to center the role of Title II. That's the part of federal communications law that gives the agency the power to even go about overseeing corporate control of the Internet, to push against price gouging, anti-privacy moves, access throttling, the whole range of things that make people hate their Internet service providers and make the Internet a less hospitable arena for activism and organizing. And that's before you even get to whether they're allowed to shut off service during national crises like COVID. The FCC, under the sway of corporations and their lobbyists, abandoned that Title II responsibility years ago under former chair Ajit Pai, appointed by Donald Trump, based mainly on his career as a lawyer for Verizon. With Title II invigorated, the FCC can engage net neutrality rules, those that prevent ISPs from slowing access for those that don't pony up and speeding it along for those that do, all of which machinations we as end users may not even be aware of, but that absolutely affect what we see and know and act on. Net neutrality has always been overwhelmingly supported by the U.S. public. Few people even wonder anymore whether broadband access is a fundamental, like water or electricity, or whether you should lose access if you live in an underserved area, rural or urban. But corporate powers and government enablers have shown that they will work very hard to prevent it. Remember Ajit Pai pretending that the FCC couldn't acknowledge the flood of pro-net neutrality public comments because, well, there was technical sabotage. That turned out to be a brazen lie. Net neutrality, backed by the FCC's Title II authorization, is nothing less than the ability to monitor and regulate hugely powerful companies' control over an essential element of public life, the ability to inform yourself, to communicate, to participate socially and politically. In other words, we should expect pushback, both loud and subtle. We've already seen headlines like the Wall Street Journal suggestion that a newly empowered FCC chair moves to rekindle net neutrality fight between tech and telecom giants. Well, fighting, that sounds bad. And then where are we in a fight between tech and telecom giants? The thing is, there is something very important for all of us at stake here. So look out for coverage that suggests otherwise. And finally, as U.S. citizens were being subjected to media massaging of the history of September 11th, 2001, with familiar stories about how we were all wrong about the reasons to invade Iraq and we were all surprised by the disastrous outcomes, The Economist was working to massage our understanding of September 11th, 1973, when the Chilean government, led by Democratic Socialist Salvador Allende, was overthrown in a violent coup d'etat by U.S.-supported General Augusto Pinochet. In a late August edition, the Smart People magazine told readers that Chile is still haunted by the coup. And in its blurb for social media, they explained how they would like us to feel about that. Quote, "It would be better for Chile if Salvador Allende and Augusto Pinochet became purely historical figures rather than sources of political inspiration, allowing the country to look forward. Clearly, that is still hard." Close quote. Clearly, it would be better for The Economist, the voice of the Anglo-American business class, if Salvador Allende were a purely historical figure, meaning that no one would take political inspiration from his example of trying to use the electoral system to change an exploitative economic system. But as the magazine laments, getting people to accept that the elected president and the dictator who overthrew him are just two sides of the same coin, well, that's still hard, as well it should be. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Major news media outlets have been putting out numerous stories on the federal indictment of Robert Menendez, Democratic senator from New Jersey and chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Those stories are overwhelmingly on details of the charges of suspect dealings. Interesting, important information, and on the support or lack thereof from other Congress members. Also, undoubtedly meaningful information. The September 27th New York Times explained that, quote, Mr. Menendez was charged on Friday with using his power as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee to assist the government of Egypt and businessmen in New Jersey in exchange for bribes that included bars of gold bullion, a Mercedes-Benz convertible, exercise machines, and more than $500,000 in cash, close quote. That sentence says a little more than it says in that it reflects U.S. media's evident prioritizing of details of the alleged corruption. What did he get? Gold, halal meat, over interest in the impact on human beings who are not Robert Menendez or his wife or her friends or any business people who got cut a sweet deal. Anyone who might be affected by this assistance to the government of Egypt. We are still in the midst of it, of course, but so far anyway, media seem more interested in what the Times called the deepening crisis Mr. Menendez faces than what it means for anybody else. Stephen Zunes is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. His most recent book, co-authored with Jacob Mundy, is Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution, out now in an updated, expanded edition from Syracuse University Press. He joins us now by phone from the Bay Area. Welcome back to Counterspin, Stephen Zunes. Well, I am absolutely going to ask your thoughts about the indictment and its implications, but I wanted to do just a little history first because it hasn't been front and center in current coverage, and that context is important. You wrote back in January of 2021 when Democrats selected Robert Menendez as chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, you wrote that that decision rung alarm bells for advocates of peace, human rights, and international law. So why was that true already then? And were there particular issue areas that drew concern?
There are quite a number. I mean, the brazenness, the jaw-dropping nature of the charges against Senator Menendez, as you noted, are great tabloid fodder. I mean, they're quite extreme. I mean, this is just not the official corruption, the legal corruption we see, you know, especially since the Citizens United decision at the Supreme Court of influencing politicians. But this is really old school in terms of the cash, the gold bars, and everything else. And he's had something of a reputation in New Jersey politics for the corruption. I mean, he was indicted some years ago on corruption charges and ended in a mistrial with a hung jury. But despite this, the Democrats named him chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. But my concern back then, as with a lot of us, was not on just the corruption per se, but he is one of the most hawkish, hardline Democrats in the United States Senate. And he was put in the very powerful position of being head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Now, historically, the Democratic heads of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee have actually tried to curb excesses in militarism and excesses in terms of supporting human rights violators and the like. We think back to J. William Fulbright, who was a leading critic, not just of Nixon, but of Lyndon Johnson in terms of the war in Vietnam. We think of Frank Church in the 1970s. Challenging the abuses by the CIA and other intelligence agencies. We think of Claiborne Pell and others. I mean, in terms of checks and balances, which unfortunately they're not a lot in foreign policy, but at least to some degree we could have it through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee when the Democrats had been in charge. But in choosing Menendez, Schumer and the Democrats went in the opposite direction, someone who has been to the right of even these centrist Democratic presidents. So Menendez was one of only two senators, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer being the other one, to vote against the Iran nuclear agreement. He has attacked Obama from the right in terms of his attempts at normalization of relations with Cuba. This latter is particularly ironic because Menendez has been obsessed with the authoritarianism and human rights abuses under Cuba's communist government, but he has been one of the most vocal supporters of U.S. support for authoritarian right-wing governments with far worse human rights abuses, including that of Egypt. And I think the big thing that the mainstream media is really missing here is not just that he apparently received bribes from a foreign government, but one that has a particularly nasty human rights record. And even without the apparent illegal activity, why in the hell is the United States supporting this government in the first place? I mean, let's remember that Egypt gets more U.S. foreign aid, more arms and ammunition and security assistance than any country in the world, save for Ukraine and Israel. And the government of Egypt is one of the absolute worst in terms of its human rights abuses. I mean, since Sisi seized power nearly a decade ago, literally thousands of demonstrators have been slaughtered in the streets. There are over 60,000 political prisoners, one of the highest, if not the highest, number of political prisoners anywhere in the world. And these aren't just Islamist radicals or anything else. Far from it. Many of these people are nonviolent, liberal, secular activists, the very people who led the nonviolent uprising in 2011 against the previous U.S.-backed dictator, Hosni Mubarak. We're talking about torture on an administrative basis, not to mention corruption up the wazoo. I mean, this is a horrific government. And yet, for years, we've had bipartisan support, both in Congress and in successive administrations, for supporting this regime. Now, there has been some growing concerns in some circles, particularly among progressive Democrats, but even among a handful of Republicans and others, about why the hell are we supporting this kind of regime? And Menendez, as head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, while occasionally giving lip service to human rights, has been steadfast in supporting this kind of aid. And indeed, part of this indictment appears to be that in return for some of these lucrative gifts, he worked to lift a hold on $300 million worth of military aid that was being temporarily withheld on human rights grounds. But the problem here, again, is not just the bribes and corruption by Menendez, but the very question that we really need to be asking is, why are we supporting this regime in the first place?
Absolutely. Well, let me just add to that, frankly, because I looked at a headline from September 14th of this year from the New York Times, choosing security over rights, U.S. approves $235 million in Egypt aid. And, it was Secretary of State Blinken overruled congressional restrictions on U.S. military aid tied to Egypt's dismal human rights record. Okay, that's interesting. But then I see another headline. Despite Egypt's dismal human rights record, U.S. restores military aid. And that headline is from 2018, so there's been this kind of, yes, no, but, and it still has added up to millions of dollars of aid.
I mean, this is all too familiar. I mean, some of us can think back to the 1980s when the Reagan administration would claim they were concerned about human rights and were pushing for human rights reforms in various Latin American dictatorships that were promoting death squads and the like. I mean, this is the same kind of thing. But the problem is that a lot of Democrats, even liberal Democrats, who have been willing to raise human rights concerns when Republicans are in the White House, seem to be rather quiet. you know, when there's a Democrat in the White House. So there's this feeling we see, and this is I certainly find this in online discussions and elsewhere, that much of the criticism about the Biden administration from the right is so silly and outrageous, and given a very real threat of authoritarianism from the Republicans, people are so reluctant to say anything negative about Biden that much of the left liberal wing of the spectrum of this country seems to be ignoring the kinds of abuses that would have mobilized people were they being supported by Republicans. And again, it's not just Egypt, and this is really important. Menendez, as head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has been a fanatically strong supporter of the Netanyahu government in Israel and the Israeli occupation. He has attacked the United Nations, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, virtually anybody who dares document or investigate violations of human rights or international humanitarian law by the Israeli government. And most Democrats at this point are starting to be, though very pro-Israel, more on the J Street end of the Zionist spectrum, that is, those that strongly support Israel as a Jewish state, but oppose the occupation and settlements. But Menendez is aligning with AIPAC and the Republicans, the right wing of the Zionist movement, and in a totally unapologetic way, which is way, way beyond to the right of average Democratic public opinion in terms of the rank and file voters. But it's not just Israel. He supports the Moroccan occupation of Western Sahara. He is one of the few who's openly supported Trump's recognition of Morocco's annexation of the entire nation of Western Sahara, along with Israel's illegal annexation of the Golan Heights. And here's a guy who talks about, Russia cannot unilaterally change international borders. They cannot expand their territory by force, in reference to Ukraine. That's certainly true. But then he says it's okay if a U.S. ally does it. And he, just like his statements on human rights, criticizing them in Cuba and other left-leaning countries, but excusing them or even supporting them in terms of right-wing U.S. allies, his attitude on international law is the same way. It's a bad violations of international legal standards, the U.N. Charter. That's a horrible thing if a country we don't like Russia, does it. But if it's an ally like Israel and Morocco, it's okay. And this is not what most Americans, especially most Democrats, want. Again, if you look at the public opinion polls, a vast majority of Americans, particularly on the Democratic side, believe that international law should be enforced consistently. I mean, just as you would not want a Democratic attorney general to only prosecute Republicans or a Republican attorney general to only prosecute Democrats, same thing with international law. Law is the law. You can't pick and choose depending on the political or geostrategic orientation of the offender.
Right. Well, against that backdrop, I think the fact that Menendez, who, as we're recording on September 28th, has pled not guilty, we're still in medias res, but he says that the federal prosecutors are misrepresenting routine congressional work. And in the context of what you've just said, I feel like that should set off an alarm for an independent press corps, right? That this is that he's even comfortable saying, well, this is just what you do when you're in a Congress.
Yes, I mean, it is concerning that even without this apparent illegal activity, even without its rather brazen nature, the fact is that it is really a scandal that the United States continues to support repressive regimes like Egypt, like Bahrain, like Saudi Arabia, like United Arab Emirates, like Morocco. They continue to support the Israeli and Moroccan occupations. I mean, you could go down the list. There's probably no single issue in foreign or domestic policy where public opinion and U.S. policy is so widely differentiated. I mean, most Americans really do feel pretty strongly about human rights. And indeed, it's what we hear all the time. I mean, it drives me crazy that to hear and people in the mainstream media, you know, without irony, talking about how Biden is standing up for human rights, standing up for international law, without mentioning that the United States arms 57% of the world's dictatorships, 57% of the world's authoritarian regimes receive U.S. military aid or arms sales. And this doesn't even count the countries that are nominally democracies, like Israel and India and others, which are also engaging in human rights abuses. So I think this scandal, on the one hand, shows the failure of the mainstream media to recognize the larger structural problem, but on the other hand, I think it provides an opening for those of us who do care about human rights, who would like to see U.S. foreign policy as actually more consistent with our stated values, to raise these issues and to challenge not just these corrupt politicians like Menendez, but the whole system that ends up supporting these autocrats and occupiers, and the kind of system that would put a man like Menendez in charge of our foreign policy in Congress, the Democrats' de facto foreign policy spokesperson, in that kind of position in the first place.
I'm going to end on that note. We've been speaking with Stephen Zunes, professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. His most recent book, co-authored with Jacob Mundy, is Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution, out now from Syracuse University Press. Stephen Zunes, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to learn about FAIR's print newsletter Extra and our Action Alert Network. And it's also the place to show much needed support for Counterspin and for the community-based stations that air our show, if you are able and so inclined. We appreciate it. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
I don't even use, sorry, a truck went by. I don't even use editing software. I mean, I try to. If it's very important, I have to chop it up because it's just too damn long. But, man, certainly no bump music like that that goes on and on. I'm sorry, Janine. All right, here we go. This is the this morning's headlines from Democracy Now!, and I'll be back with you in 13 minutes.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The UN Security Council voted Monday to deploy multinational armed forces to Haiti as the island nation combats worsening gang violence. The intervention, which came at the repeated request of U.S.-backed Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry, will be led by Kenya, marking the first deployment of international security forces to Haiti in nearly 20 years. The proposal received 13 votes in favor, with Russia and China abstaining. The resolution was drafted by the United States and Ecuador, allowing foreign troops to remain in Haiti for a year with a review after 9 months. The Biden administration pledged at least $100 million to fund the operation. This is the United States Deputy Ambassador to the UN, Jeffrey De Laurentiis.
This mission comes at the request of the Haitian government and Haitian civil society to address the insecurity and dire humanitarian crisis the country has faced for far too long. The deployment of this mission will help to support Haiti's critical near-term needs and to foster the security conditions necessary for the country to advance long-term stability.
Kenya had previously offered to contribute 1,000 police officers. The Bahamas, Jamaica, Antigua, and Barbuda have also vowed to send forces. Many Haitians have opposed the move due to the disastrous history of UN, U.S., and foreign interventions in Haiti. A UN mission that left Haiti in 2017 behind an outbreak of cholera that killed some 10,000 people. UN officials were also accused of widespread sexual violence, including the abuse of children. Amnesty International's voiced concerns about the intervention in Kenya. Kenyan-led armed forces recently citing Kenya's continued unlawful use of force against protesters. Meanwhile, peace activists have denounced the move as a U.S.-led invasion. In 2021, the U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti resigned to protest the Biden administration's policies in Haiti. In a resignation letter, the longtime diplomat Daniel Foote wrote, "What our Haitian friends really want and need is the opportunity to chart their own course without international puppeteering and favored candidates, but with genuine support for that course." Unquote. No date's been confirmed for the deployment, but U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently said it could begin within months. A United Nations mission has arrived in Nagorno-Karabakh for the first time in 30 years. As Armenia's government warns, nearly all the territory's population of 120,000 ethnic Armenians has fled following Azerbaijan's military blitz to seize the territory in September. A UN official in Armenia's capital said registration centers have been overwhelmed with huge numbers of exhausted and frightened refugees, a third of whom are children.
People are tired. This is a situation where they've lived under 9 months of blockade. It's not something that has just happened where you pick up and you go. They've suffered 9 months of blockade already, and when they come in, they're full of anxiety, they're scared, they're frightened, and they want answers. They want answers as to what's going to happen next.
Armenia has accused Azerbaijan of ethnic cleansing. On Monday, Armenia's European Union envoy urged Western nations to sanction Azerbaijan, including its lucrative oil and gas industry, and requested military aid for Armenia. Here in the United States, the Supreme Court opens its new term Monday, hearing oral arguments in a case that will determine who's eligible for reduced prison sentences under the First Step Act, which rolls back mandatory minimum sentences for certain people convicted of nonviolent drug charges. Today's Supreme Court justices are hearing a case brought by a predatory payday lending group challenging the leadership structure of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Legal experts warn the outcome of the case could undermine other regulatory agencies and federal programs, including Medicare and Social Security. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court has denied an appeal without comment by Texas death row prisoner Robert Roberson, who has always maintained his innocence. He was convicted in 2003 of murdering his two-year-old daughter. His lawyers say he was convicted on the basis of testimony by forensic experts who'd cited the shaken baby syndrome hypothesis, which was popularized in the early 2000s but never scientifically validated. Last month, a New Jersey appeals court ruled the theory is junk science. In more news from the Supreme Court, Justice Clarence Thomas recused himself from a case Monday involving former Trump legal advisor John Eastman, who formerly served as a law clerk for Thomas. This follows reports Justice Thomas's wife, the Republican activist Ginni Thomas, corresponded with Eastman ahead of the January 6, 2021 insurrection about efforts to reverse the results of the 2020 election to keep Trump in power. Justice Thomas, however, did not recuse himself from a case backed by New York landlords challenging the city's rent stabilization policies. The anti-corruption group, the Revolving Door Project, wrote in response, quote, Justice Thomas's billionaire benefactor Harlan Crow has a vested interest in weakening rent control laws across the country to buttress his real estate empire's profits, unquote. On Capitol Hill, Republican Florida Congressmember Matt Gaetz introduced a resolution Monday to remove House Speaker Kevin McCarthy from his leadership position. Gaetz and other far-right Republicans blasted McCarthy after he brokered a deal on a short-term funding bill that averted a government shutdown. Gaetz also blames McCarthy for making a, quote, secret Ukraine side deal with Democrats, which McCarthy denies. Vice President Kamala Harris is swearing in a new member of California's Senate delegation today following the death of long-term Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein last week. LaFonza Butler becomes the first openly lesbian black senator and just the third black woman to serve in the Senate in U.S. history. Donald Trump appeared in a Manhattan courtroom Monday for the start of a civil trial brought by New York Attorney General Letitia James. Trump and his business partners, including his adult sons, Eric and Donald Trump Jr., are accused of fraudulently inflating the value of the Trump Organization's assets by billions to obtain loans and favorable business deals. James is seeking to fine Trump $250 million and is asking for a permanent ban on Trump family members running a business in New York.
No matter how powerful you are, no matter how much money you think you may have, no one is above the law. And it is my responsibility and my duty and my job to enforce it. The law is both powerful and fragile. And today in court, we will prove our case.
Trump will receive a bench trial presided over by New York Supreme Court Justice Arthur Engoron after Trump's lawyers did not request a jury trial. Speaking to reporters outside the court Monday, Trump assailed Attorney General James, who is African-American, as a racist and called Judge Engoron a disgrace.
He's a Democrat operative, and he's a disgrace to people that call themselves judges. He's a judge that should be disbarred. This is a judge that should be out of office. This is a judge that some people say could be charged criminally for what he's doing.
On Monday, over 30 advocacy groups, including CREW, that's Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, and Public Citizen, published an open letter calling for the protection of juries in Trump's four ongoing criminal cases. The letter cites Trump's harassment of jurors in Georgia and Washington, D.C., adding, quote, these attacks threaten centuries-old American institutions designed by the framers to hold to account any leader who would be king, unquote. The U.S. Department of Labor has launched an investigation into child labor at poultry processors Purdue and Tyson Foods. The probe comes after lawmakers grilled the head of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration about reports in the New York Times about migrant children getting burned and maimed on the job at Purdue and Tyson slaughterhouses. This is North Carolina Democratic Congressmember Alma Adams, the ranking Democrat on House Workforce Protection Subcommittee, whose repeated requests for a hearing on child labor violations have gone ignored by the committee's Republican chair, Virginia Fox.
Thanks to recent news investigations, we also know that children, especially unaccompanied migrant children, have been suffering all manner of harms in jobs that they should not be working on in the first place. But take a closer look at those stories. Chemicals so caustic that they burn through multiple layers of gloves, machines without guards to prevent people's arms or hands from getting mangled, food dust and cleaning chemical fumes that irritate the sinuses and lungs. These stories are not only about children in desperate circumstances, they're also about workplaces that are dangerous to people of all ages.
To see our interview with the New York Times Hannah Dreyer about her investigation into child labor in the United States, go to democracynow.org. The World Health Organization's approved the use of a more affordable and highly effective vaccine against malaria. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus announced the recommendation Monday.
In areas with seasonal transmission, it reduced symptomatic cases of malaria by 75% in the 12 months following a three-dose series of the vaccine.
The vaccine was developed by Oxford University as only the second malaria vaccine to be recommended by the WHO. Malaria is among the world's deadliest infectious diseases, and the mosquito that carries it has been described as the world's deadliest animal. In 2021, over 500,000 people, largely children under the age of 5, died of malaria, the vast majority of them in Africa. In California, the longtime community leader and beloved bilingual newspaper publisher Dolores Sanchez has died at the age of 87. For nearly four decades, Sanchez presided over Eastern Group Publications, which operated 11 newspapers, bringing news to Latinx communities on Los Angeles' east side and neighboring cities. And press freedom groups are calling on Congress to pass new legislation protecting media workers on the fifth anniversary of the state-sponsored killing of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi by Saudi Arabia in Istanbul in 2018. The Khashoggi Act, introduced Monday, would allow lawsuits in the United States against governments implicated in extraterritorial repression. The separate Khashoggi resolution pledges U.S. action to hold the Saudi government accountable for human rights abuses. On Monday, elected officials in Los Angeles welcomed friends and family of Jamal Khashoggi to a street dedication ceremony on a stretch of Wilshire Boulevard outside the consulate of Saudi Arabia. A sign declaring the space Jamal Khashoggi Square reads, quote, "a journalist and advocate for human rights slain by the Saudi government," unquote. In Washington, D.C., the National Press Club held a moment of silence to remember Khashoggi and other journalists whose killings had gone unpunished. Joining the ceremony was Michael Omerman, Director of Research for Israel-Palestine at Dawn, the organization founded by Jamal Khashoggi.
Whereas Jamal's death outraged the world and seemed for a moment to inject human rights into U.S. foreign policy in the MENA region, today, unfortunately, that no longer seems to be the case. That's most apparent in Saudi Arabia, but not only. Following the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, we saw how the U.S. government literally tried to redefine accountability in order to shield an ally from scrutiny. This is unacceptable. Jamal was murdered for the power of his ideas, and because even in the face of mortal danger, he refused to remain silent.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
You can really get Democracy Now! Here in northeast Kansas by just, it comes on 7 o'clock every morning on the weekdays on your television, 19.2 over the air antenna. It's the Kansas City KCPT PBS affiliate. And at 8 o'clock, you can get it, our local community radio station, KKFI. It's, I believe, 90.5, I think. I hope I'm right. Or 90.1 FM. But you could sit. We're right on the edge. Jefferson County is right on the edge of getting it. Now, we're going to plunge into the second hour with this hoopla over the Canadian Parliament giving two rounds of a standing ovation applause for Zelensky. Well, not Zelensky, mainly this 98-year-old former SS officer from Ukraine, a Nazi. We're going to go into this, and you can listen to it. This is Canadian broadcasting. I guess. Well, just be the judge. This is how they covered it. This is how Canadian Broadcasting Radio, I think it's called Front End, is the radio segment. Anyhow, here we go.
Hi, I'm Tamara Kendacker.
Thank you.
So by now, you've most likely heard this clip of House of Commons Speaker Anthony Rota from late last week, but I feel like it's worth hearing one more time.
We have here in the chamber today Ukrainian-Canadian world veteran from the Second World War who fought the Ukrainian independence against the Russians and continues to support the troops today, even at his age of 98.
That's Rota, honoring Yaroslav Hanka and the House when Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was there on Friday. Hanka got two standing ovations from Parliament.
He's a Ukrainian hero, a Canadian hero, and we thank him for all his service. Thank you.
But as we later learned, Hanka fought the Russians because he fought with the Nazis in a division called the SS 14th Waffen, a revelation that's caused outrage and embarrassment, prompting Rota to apologize and take responsibility. Yesterday, he gave in to calls to resign as Speaker.
It's with a heavy heart that I rise to inform members of my resignation as Speaker of the House of Commons.
But what is this SS division? Why are there still two monuments to it in Canada? And how did a man who fought for a division commanded by the Nazis end up living here? David Pugliese with the Ottawa Citizen is back with answers. He's been covering military issues for four decades. Hi, David. Thanks so much for doing this.
Oh, great to be here. Hello.
Start with what happened on Friday with Ukraine's president in attendance, Canada Speaker of the House of Commons, proudly recognized Yaroslav Hanka, saying that he fought against the Russians in the Second World War. And I know this is fairly basic history, but why should fought against the Russians have at least raised eyebrows here?
Yeah, so it is basic history, but a lot of Canadians don't know their basic history. If he fought against the Russians during the Second World War, that means he was fighting on the side of the Nazis. The Russians were allied with the U.S., Canada, Britain, and the various allied powers to defeat Nazi Germany.
And so what did you think when you first heard what Rota said?
When I saw it, I thought, oh, God, what is he doing? Because I knew immediately.
Right.
So Friday night, you know, I listened to that. And then soon enough, emails started coming in from various Jewish organizations. They realized what was going on immediately. They were shocked. Then a University of Ottawa professor did some more digging, found a website honoring 14th SS Galicia. That's the Waffen SS organization of the Third Reich. They were made up of Ukrainians. And there was Mr. Hanka on that site. He volunteered for the Waffen SS. And there were photos of him in his Nazi uniform and at the front fighting with the Nazi Germany.
What do we know at this point about how Hanka ended up at Zelensky's address in the House of Commons? How did he get invited?
Well, there's a couple of stories. I mean, Rota has, the House Speaker has taken responsibility for inviting him.
I recognize an individual in the gallery. I have subsequently become aware of more information which causes me to regret my decision to do so, he says in a statement.
I just want to make it clear that it was my decision and my decision alone. And I apologize profusely. I cannot tell you how regretful it is. And it may not be good enough for
There's
you.
Been suggestions now that Mr. Hanka's son asked that he be invited and put in the gallery. And, you know, when the House Speaker introduced him, he received two standing ovations from all MPs. And among those guests that he received a standing ovation from was Chief of Defense Staff General Wayne Eyre,
right,
who was seated nearby.
So there's been quite a bit of reaction since then. As you said, Speaker Rota said this was entirely his decision. He apologized and resigned, although he didn't actually specifically mention Hanka in his apology. The Prime Minister called this
deeply embarrassing to the Parliament of Canada and by extension to all Canadians. I think
his office said that this was all Rota's doing. But what else have Jewish groups and other countries been calling for?
This a little bit in context. This is the first time that a member of the Waffen-SS has been honored in Canada's parliament.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll stop on that and let that sink in. So what's happening now, you know, the Jewish groups, three Jewish groups have banded together and they've put out news releases condemning this, linking, you know, the Waffen-SS and 14th SS Galicia to war crimes. Poland has asked for an official apology from Canada. It hasn't received it because the 14th Waffen-SS has been implicated in the murders of Polish civilians mm-hmm. during the Second World War. And this morning, the Polish education minister announced that he is starting extradition proceedings for Mr. Hunka.
Wow. Quite a turn of events for Mr. Hunka. Let's just talk about Russia's reaction for a second. So one of Russian President Vladimir Putin's justifications for his invasion of Ukraine is that they're trying to denazify the country. That's what he's been saying from the beginning. So how has Russia responded to our parliament applauding Hunka?
Well, Russia is using this as part of its propaganda campaign against Ukraine.
Russia is seizing on this controversy in Canada's parliament, saying it's outrageous. A Ukrainian veteran who fought for a Nazi unit was presented as a hero in the House of Commons. Here's a Kremlin spokesperson speaking earlier.
Such a sloppy attitude towards memory. And memory must be preserved in relation to the Nazis, no matter how old they are. There is no statute of limitations for these crimes. Such sloppiness in this memory is, of course, outrageous.
You know, it's interesting that Prime Minister Trudeau said, oh, we have to be careful about Russian disinformation. But it was the Canadian government, the House of Commons, that has presented Russia with this propaganda coup. So, you know, I think MPs and the House of Commons should look towards themselves for their role in this.
I want to learn a little bit more about this unit that Hunka served in. This is the 14th Waffen Grenadier Division of the SS, which is often called the 1st Galician. Mm-hmm. How was it formed and what was the role that it was supposed to play in the war?
So in 1943, the Germans were realizing that they were starting to lose the war. The Russians were pushing into German-occupied territory. Landings, Canadians and Brits were landing in places like Italy. So the noose was tightening. They needed more manpower. So in their occupied areas, particularly in Eastern Europe, they had already used some of the local population to murder the Jewish population. They put out recruiting for these new SS units. So in 1943, the Waffen SS 14th Galician was formed. And so they were put to the front, you know, to fight the Russians. They were used later on to crush uprisings in occupied Nazi territories.
Mm-hmm.
They've been allegedly involved in the massacre of civilians in a number of Polish villages. Near the end of the war, when, you know, it was obvious that Germany was defeated, the 14th Waffen-SS renamed itself in the final days of the war as the 1st Ukrainian. And so that's why sometimes you get this confusion. But the SS never recognized that officially. And it's seen as more of a, you know, they knew the war was finished and the Allies weren't looking, you know, kindly on SS units.
Mm-hmm. And why might some Ukrainians have wanted to join this division?
So there's obviously a hatred of Russia in some parts of Ukraine. The Russians, Stalin had been involved in the starvation of Ukrainians. There's war crimes on the Russian side. And so the Nazis used that hatred and they put out, you know, the call for volunteers. You know, the recruiting poster, for instance, had an octopus-type creature with a hook nose and a Jewish symbol on it.
Mm.
And you had this SS man with a sword ready to cut its head off. So, you know, the Nazis were saying, well, the Jews are behind communism, behind Bolsheviks, and so join us to fight them.
Right.
So you had 80,000 Ukrainians volunteer for the division. Around 10,000 were selected. However, it's interesting to note that you also had 4.6 million Ukrainians fight for the Red Army, the Soviet Army.
Mm-hmm.
So that just shows you kind of the split in Ukrainian society at the time.
Right, of course. So we haven't heard from Hunka himself, and we don't know if he had personal involvement in some of these atrocities that you mentioned, but he was in this division. And what else do we know about the time that he served based on this website that you mentioned where we learned that he was part of this unit?
Well, he said he enjoyed himself immensely. It was one of the high points of his life. I mean, the photos he's published or that were published of him show basic training, also shows him behind an anti-aircraft gun or with a group of his fellow SS soldiers. So he doesn't go into a lot of detail about that. And I would add that, you know, it's going to be very hard for Poland to extradite him unless they have actual evidence placing him at the scene of some of these alleged war crimes. And the Poles haven't produced anything like that at this point.
So I think this story took a lot of people by surprise, not just because he was recognized in Parliament, but also because here you have someone who fought under Nazi command living freely in Canada. And if you don't know the history, you might think surviving Nazis would have been imprisoned after the war. So how did members of the 14th Division end up coming here after the war?
So after the war, the International Military Tribunal labeled the Waffen-SS and the SS as a criminal organization. But what happened was there is some push among the Ukrainian community in Canada to welcome these veterans. There is, at the time, though, there were other Ukrainians who said, no, we don't want these individuals. They were allowed to come to this country, 2,000 of them. And over the years, this situation has been percolating. In the 1980s, Jewish groups raised concerns about war crimes. You had the Duchesne Commission, which looked into the matter, at least partially, but it concluded that despite what the International Military Tribunal said, involvement with SS Galicia was not in itself a crime. And so what's been happening is Holocaust survivors die off, as our own Canadian war veterans die off. You see a revisionism that's happening, where in some of these Eastern European nations, like Latvia, Estonia, and Ukraine, these individuals who fought for the Nazis against the Russians are now being seen as heroes in some people's eyes.
The report from this commission in the 1980s, am I right that hundreds of pages of that report are still classified?
Yeah, part of the report is out there in the public domain. There was another secondary report that had more details about the potential war crimes that the government had found out about. So that was released in 2022 through the Access to Information Act. It was 1,237 pages. Only 600 pages were released. So there's another, you know, the rest of it is still classified.
So I was kind of surprised to learn that there are actually still two monuments to this SS division in Canada, one in Oakville and one in Edmonton. There's also been marches quite recently that honor this division in Ukraine. So help me understand that. Why would someone want to commemorate this group?
Again, it's because this has been portrayed as this unit fought against the Russians. And so in some eyes of some Ukrainian nationalists, they're seen as heroes. Except, you know, in Poland, they're not seen as heroes. They're seen as war criminals. In Slovakia, there's been allegations of war crimes as well. So it comes down to viewpoints of the war. Polish and Jewish groups have been trying to get these monuments taken down. You know, it's interesting to note 40,000 Ukrainian Canadians fought for our side during the Second World War, and there isn't a monument for them.
So today, we've talked about this on the show before, there are fighters in Ukraine with neo-Nazi links or who wear symbols the Nazis made infamous. I'm thinking of the Azov Brigade, for example. Why are these Nazi symbols still held up by small groups in Ukraine?
I mean, it's hard to explain. Well, it's hard to understand, I guess. So Azov started off as a far-right organization, so it's not unusual that they would embrace Nazi symbols. Now, with the terrible Russian invasion of Ukraine, people are saying, well, Azov has changed its tune. It's now just a regular unit. They've gotten rid of all this Nazi symbolism and far-right symbolism. But what you're still seeing on social media, lots of swastikas, lots of Nazi salutes, the Black Sun, for instance, which is a symbol that Heinrich Himmler, head of the SS, used. Mm-hmm. NATO was embarrassed last year when it published photos online, social media, to highlight Ukrainian women fighting. They had the Black Sun Nazi insignia on their uniform. So NATO had to quickly remove that. So you're seeing that all the time. You just go on social media, and it's providing the Russians with a propaganda gift.
And so just picking up on what Putin has been arguing here, we've just gone through a bunch of Second World War history that highlights how some Ukrainians fought with the Nazis, but what should we make of that in today's context where Putin is saying he wants to denazify Ukraine? How should people weigh those two things?
Well, I think they're separate issues. You know, what Putin is saying is obviously wrong. The invasion is wrong. But you don't go, okay, well, Ukrainian Nazis are okay because now Ukraine is fighting the Russians. You could say, for instance, Osama bin Laden fought the Russians in Afghanistan in the early days, and we're not erecting a statue towards him or a monument towards him. So I think totally two separate issues. And these Jewish groups and the Poles, they have valid concerns here. To put it bluntly, Canada fought against the Third Reich, fought against the Nazis. So it is mind-boggling that SS soldier was honored by our MPs, by our parliament.
Yeah. And I wonder what you make of the fact that it was news to some Canadians that there were former Nazi fighters living here, or that there was even a Ukrainian division commanded by the Nazis. Is there a lesson that we can take from that, or this whole disaster about how we remember our history?
I mean, these are basic historical facts. This isn't hidden history. And this has been debated repeatedly. I mean, we've, you know, the monuments, for instance, that was in the news several years ago. And then there's the big controversy about it. So it just continues on. It's there. I think public officials.
It's there. It's there. It's there. History, there's history there somewhere. There's Nazis among us. They're still alive. We got John Grant on the phone. I've been bugging the shit out of him about this story, and I want to get him on air. John,
what's
you're
the phone
on air.
Ringing? I know, but there's a phone ringing. Somebody answer the phone.
That's the Big Lebowski. The Big Lebowski calling in. And he's telling me.
Hey, there's a beverage here, man. Dude, yeah.
The Nazi rug centers the room. It centers the room. You know what I mean? It makes the room
complete.
having a Nazi
so,
braided rug.
Hold up. What do you think of that report?
Well, I want to make sure the audience gets clear. That was a official Canadian broadcasting company or corporation broadcast in the immediate aftermath of the scandal that's already cost the Speaker of the Parliament his job. Well, he hasn't quit yet, but he's no longer Speaker. He quit that. And Justin Trudeau, oh, my God. Now, this guy, I guess you would call him right out of the Democratic Party cloth, I mean, of the United States.
He's classic liberal, I guess, yeah.
But wasn't his dad a prime minister also?
Yeah, well, his dad was the hip dude, chancellor, prime minister, had a beautiful wife, remember? It was, he was a handsome hip dude, and his son, of course, rode in on that wagon,
He's eating untold buckets of shit right now, but with a spoon. And no, he is, because there's a lot of people want Mr. Trudeau, Prime Minister Trudeau, to resign too for this scandal.
In there a long time, so he's not naturally become kind of a lightning rod.
There's Mr. Grant's historical context. But now, come on. Okay, I mean,
what?
I think it's a big deal.
What are we talking about?
This Nazi being exposed. I mean, this guy was in the SS, and then it's like you pick up a rock and you look under it. Anti-war critic and former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter. Now you got to look around, but he's there. He talks about in upstate New York there are monuments and cemeteries for Ukrainian fascists, and they have a camp for young men, young Ukrainian men, that they go around, you know, worshiping the Ukrainian fascists.
I just think we need some perspective here. You know, we need a little perspective.
Here's another one. Go ahead.
Whenever you're done,
it's your turn. Okay.
Right. Okay.
I was laughing about it because when you pick up the rock, there's an article in the American Conservative magazine The Guardian about a thing called Red Caesar. And it's a political trend out of Hillsdale College of a whole school of scholars and writers. Both in mainstream media and, you know, on the fringe of the right, talking about how an authoritarian regime of, in their color, red Republican, GOP, is preferable to what Biden is doing, to anything Democrat. So you lift that rock up and you see the very same kind of people breaching the Capitol building on January 6th. There were a lot of not fascists, not necessarily German Nazis, but fascists, white Christian nationalists, who were involved in the January 6th thing. So to me, it's like the Nazis are amongst us. You know, now it's back to you, John Grant. What do you think of that?
Well, certainly we've known of, you know, for the last, 70, 80 years, you know, that Nazis, you know, were, you know, I mean, they made our rockets and stuff, you know. I mean, we know there's been crossovers all over the place, up the wazoo. And, but I guess, you know, citing something, you know, somebody that was in the, where he must be ancient, this guy, if he was in the SS in World War II. My God.
Yeah, 98. He's 98.
Yeah, there you go. He volunteered. Okay.
To join the Ukraine, joined the SS at 19. And there's photographs.
Well, somebody just said in that report, cited a ruling or a judgment that just because you were in the SS doesn't mean you're a war criminal. I was in the United States Army in Vietnam, and the United States Army did war crimes in Vietnam, I'm not guilty of war crimes. I'm just guilty of being a jerk and joining the fucking thing. You know, so it's, you know, it's common. Plus, it's like 80 years ago, you know. What gets me is now I'm going to wade into a minefield here, I guess, because this is the nature of the business. But, you know, Israelis and Jews citing this as a big problem, just wait a goddamn minute here. You know, what about Israel now? If you're a Palestinian in the West Bank, Israel looks like a bunch of goddamn fascists. Okay, so now they're upset that somebody might have been a Nazi 80 years ago. Well, how about somebody, you know, who wants to be a Nazi right now, you know, who wants to crush people right now, who wants to occupy the West Bank right now. Now, they're not Nazis, but, you know, they're toying with the F word, fascism. I just read a story today about, you know, Palestinians, complaining that these settlers burst into their house and harass them in their own damn house, you know, and this is going on. It's getting worse and worse and worse. Now, I'm not making a big deal out of this. I'm just saying, you know, there's dealing with the reality now, and then there's fighting, oh, gotcha, something that was 80 years ago, you know. You know, it's a complicated world, and history's complicated and all this, and yes, you know, so I guess what does it mean that some guy who's 98 years old was in the SS and is now speaking up pro-Ukraine? Now,
well, I got
war,
he got
me,
two,
to me, war, especially World War II, is a horrible, horrible business. People died in horrible, horrible ways on both sides all around. And the Nazis were the worst of the worst. I saw Luciano Visconti's movie The Damned last night about barons who ran a steel mill in Nazi Germany after the Reichstag fire. It was incredible. It's called The Damned, and they deserve to be called The Damned. So this is, I mean, the world is full of horrible people. The history is horrible people. So what are we, you know, what are we talking about here? Do we talk about, well, we dropped the funding because some guy 80 years ago was in the SS is now for it? I don't know what all this means. So, you know, we need to discuss this on a serious, rational, reasonable manner. But, you know, it becomes a sort of a, you know, a political football.
My goal is to kick that ball back to John Grant. Now,
I gave my shot. You know, what do you think?
Okay, first off, you talked about your military involvement in Vietnam.
I was just citing that as an example.
Now, right. Well, let me give you a big difference here. Okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The Nuremberg
trials
held in after World War II and through 45 through 53, but basically, said they found that the SS, and this is a quote, was a complete criminal organization that internationally is recognized.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a complete criminal organization. It was
every
not
other
even part
World
of the
War
old,
II movie
was,
demonizes them,
even,
absolutely.
It was not even part of a proper German military organization. That is from Nuremberg.
Fair enough.
Okay. So to be a Ukrainian volunteer into the SS, okay, is even more evil, if there is such a thing as evil. And I do believe there is when it comes to this kind of stuff.
Well, so
and
do
then
I.
For,
I believe in absolutely. Yeah.
Now, the question among the Jewish people that I've watched, monitored, was did Trudeau
mm-hmm.
and the Speaker of the House know that this guy was a certifiable war criminal, all right?
And now, excuse me, let me back up and clarify here. This guy spoke out how?
If you were, well, let me give you an example. If you were invited to a joint House session of Congress with your favorite guy, and they were going to give you two standing ovations for Vietnam, okay?
Okay.
Do you really think that you would not be vetted and checked into your background before they put you up there to do that? Huh? You don't think they'd look into your background?
This guy was celebrated in the Canadian legislature? What are you saying? I'm not sure.
Yeah,
the
National Parliament.
Uh-huh.
This
98-year-old SS veteran.
Zelensky,
why
was
he honored?
For fighting against the Russians.
Okay,
exactly,
fighting against the Russians. Exactly. Right. Well, that, to me, is the key, the crux to all this. You know, again, it's about the reality of war, which is an ugly business, and nobody's a good guy. You know, we're all gray, sort of bad guys, and, you know, it's a degrees of gray and black, you know. And but war's a nasty business. So, yeah, war right now, 2023 versus war again 80 years ago. You know, I know people that my cousin married a woman from Belarus, and her parents, the woman, Mrs. Rusak, put up German Nazi soldiers in her home in Belarus when she was a child. And she would write with this Nazi soldier. And she said he was a very nice young man. And, you know, so, war's a mess. And so these things, you know, I don't know what it means. That's where the political football comes in. What does this mean? Now we're trying to say that... The prime minister, quote, knew that this man was a Nazi 80 years ago in the SS. Well, he may deny that. Nobody knows. Again, what does it mean? I guess to me, you know, the reality of very, very nasty war right now is what's important. And, you know, all wars are run. We ran the Contra war by hiring criminals because we needed people to run guns, and criminals ran drugs, and they knew the routes, and so we hired criminals. You know, war is a criminal enterprise, and so criminals gravitate to it. You have to hire criminals to kill people. I mean, it's, to me, you know, so... Naturally, you're going to find somebody in the Ukraine history that's rather unsavory. I don't think that's a surprise. I guess I'm being a super realist or something. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, you can call yourself what? Yeah, you can call yourself that. Missouri. I don't know if it's a senator or. Representative, but he's pretty popular. He's a Republican, mm-hmm. and he's at D.C. There's a famous photo of him. His name is Josh Hawley H A W L.
Oh right, he's a senator. He waved at the guys on January 6th.
Yeah, waved,
right.
Gave him the power.
He's from what? Missouri, I think. Something.
Missouri.
Like that.
Oh yeah, yeah. Now he came out after his meeting. Mm-hmm. Joint meeting with Zelensky. Just this last time, Zelensky did his comedy tour through here. Okay, and
okay.
and then
he has
a great
olive drab, olive drab fashion. He's a fashion plate. Yeah,
yeah. He went up there get his hand out, and this is right before the threat of a government shutdown.
Right.
Okay, and he comes out of that chamber with Zelensky and the other members of Congress there on financing, and they'd already received a message. This is what he said. He said they'd already received a message, a request for an additional $24 billion, $6 billion of which would come this month. And more
so
aid.
Hawley said this? Hawley?
Hawley said this right okay. out of the okay. chamber where they were secretly meeting with Zelensky.
Gotcha.
Okay. And he comes out and he says they want another $24 billion. They want $6 billion now before the government vote on the shutdown. They want that tied on to the shutdown. Mm-hmm. This is Hawley. And he's, and I believe him. I don't like the guy, but I believe what he said. And he said, most importantly, what I took out of it, he said, not one penny is being accounted for. He said, there's no inspector general on any of these funds. This money is going, nobody knows where. The federal, U.S. federal government, nobody knows where. That's what he said, and I believe it. I absolutely believe it. And
he may be right.
Well, I mean, how close you got to get to the source? I mean, he just came out, literally shut the door and came out and said that.
Yeah, but Hawley
he's not lying.
Is, you know, a soiled character. He's,
well,
you know, his credibility is not the best, let's put it that way.
I guess the next time you need to strap on a polygraph machine before you'll even consider his opinion. But I mean, I'm not that way because I live among these people, and there is a streak of isolationism that still hasn't left since George W. Bush and Operation Iraqi Freedom. Okay,
right.
There is a stiff isolationist among whatever you want to call them. Okay, now they like I hinted earlier, there's this paradigm shift that's been going on very slowly since Donald Trump. And there is a paradigm shift about maybe we need a red Caesar, a Republican Caesar to run this country because it's going so far off the rails.
I understand that sentiment, that movement, absolutely. I agree. You know, I don't agree with it, obviously, but I certainly think that's what Donald Trump is hoping for. He's hoping he can be elected, he could be elected Hitler in 1933,
He never really says how he would get off the, how he would end the bloodshed in Ukraine. He hasn't, he said he'd do it in 24 hours. Now, what does that mean?
We know the man has an affinity for Vladimir Putin, who is, the big chump in all this. We all look at Vladimir Putin and we go, holy shit, man, this guy, is a monster.
Well, that's your pronoun. Not
well,
mine.
Donald Trump likes him. They had that meeting we have no idea what they were talking about together in Helsinki. I mean, that's outrageous. And Vladimir Putin's, does interference for Donald Trump in the election, and he plans to do it again. He said so. I just don't want an ally of Vladimir Putin in the White House. I just think that's really a disaster. You're asking for real, real problems. So again, it's what does all this mean? And is there corruption in Ukraine? Of course there is. We know that. I mean, that's obvious. There's corruption everywhere. There's corruption in America. I hate to break anybody's bubble, corruption is the way of the world in the 21st century. Menendez, look at Menendez, this guy, he thinks he's going to get away again with he takes gold bullion from some Egyptian, it's like,
wow.
I mean, the smell is just amazing, to me, it's like that scene in Casablanca. You mean, in Claude Rains comes in and he says, oh, You mean there's gambling going on in here? Alas, yes.
Well, I don't equate, I don't know. I don't know if I could be that broad and painting over some of this.
But what is it? What is it? This stuff means as far as funding the Ukraine war against Vladimir Putin's, you know, attack, invasion of, you know, Ukraine. That's the issue. I mean, if we drop the funding now in midstream, you know, he'll just what? Why is
it
funny?
Go ahead, listen. I mean, it just rings to me a lot of this stuff that you're saying. It sort of reminds me of how, I don't mean to piss you off, but I mean, it reminds me a lot of the way the Republicans apologized about Ronald Reagan and Ollie North funneling money to Central America. It's like deja vu, but on a bigger scale. I mean, you know, the Contras were being funded.
No, I understand that, and I've dealt with Vetsra Peace people. In fact, I'm alienated from Vetsra Peace because of these clowns. That, you know, they apologize for Assad, they apologize for Putin, you know, and I went, what the fuck, man? Why are you apologizing for Vladimir Putin? That we're picking on the poor man, you know, NATO's picking on him, you know, like, no.
Well,
but Russia is not the same as the Contra War. I hate to tell people this. These are post-World War II unnecessary U.S. imperial wars that we, starting with Vietnam, that should never have happened. They should have been, you know, some negotiations and certain things. You know, we all fought against those wars. This is completely different situation. This is the old imperialism is dead. The old imperialism, the old colonialism and all that is finished. Thanks to the internet and social media and all this crazy atomization of information and the information wars and all this craziness and high tech, you know, rocketing up, zooming up AI now. We got AI, we got robotics. We got cyber war, and we got within cyber war, we got special ops. We don't have big armies anymore. They just mothballed like what $65 billion worth of these ships that were specially designed to bring troops into, you know, into shore on all these troubled spots in the world. Well, they're useless now because war has changed, because technology has changed war. So they're mothballing $65 billion worth of ships that are no longer useful to them because they were like last season's war, if you will. And instead, they're spending all this money, you know, probably billions, buying up things like Barnes & Noble drones, because the Ukraine war made it quite clear that Barnes & Noble based drones are very, very useful in the warfare of the 21st century. So, you know, everything is evolving and changing. So, I don't know. It's just, to me, I call it the new imperialism, you know, which involves China as an imperial nation. I mean, China was a developing nation. It was a imperial or a colonized nation up until the 21st century, let's say. So now China, India, you know, certainly Russia is an imperialist country now. Look, that's why they fucking invaded Ukraine. And the United States, you know, we're just trying to stay alive and stay together because, you know, over the last 40 years developed all these enemies that want to take us out. So, you know, it's a new world based on a new system of, you know, imperialism and, you know, a new great game, if you will, that's not the same as Contra War, Vietnam, even Iraq. those were post-World War II wars. Now we're dealing with, I don't know how else to put it, World War III. This is World War III. You know, do we, can we negotiate our way out of World War III, or are we doomed? I don't know. I don't know. But it seems like the more I look at it, as you know, this is a whole new ball game, and it's pretty scary. You know.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have the answers. I don't have the answers, but you know, I some guy who was in the SS 80 years ago is 98 years old. You know.
Yeah.
I don't know what that has to do with right now. You know.
Well, I think what's happening worldwide, especially in, I know in Canada right now, and I think to a large extent Americans are, to a certain extent, Americans are very, very spoiled rotten. Their lives
are not interrupted by
foreign policy. They're, as long as foreign policy doesn't interfere in their lives, they don't fucking care. Now, I'm very cynical about that, but I'm trying to be gentle.
Well, that's why Carvel's idea of it's the economy, stupid, is what counts. Is all they care about is their posh,
right?
Soft
chairs
for their soft ass. You know, I mean, that's Americans.
Right,
And I
do think Josh Hawley, Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, has a point, because there is a movement now.
Maybe.
I'll tell you something. There's a movement among. Now, is it just? I think it's a big show. I think it's a show until 2025. I think they're acting anti-war. They're acting anti-war from a libertarian perspective.
Right.
One of my heroes, Ray McGovern, former retired senior CIA analyst who composed the presidential daily brief for Reagan and I think another president.
Bush won.
Ray has been appearing on a show, and I want to heartily recommend it. It's called Dialogue Works on YouTube, and he appeared this last week. This is the thing that's happening with me. I see this this recognition of today. It's a different. You talked about the difference in history and how we have the people at large have access to history if they want to. Do the research. It's available out there on the internet, and it's not conspiracy or rabbit hole. You can actually, they dug up a photograph of this guy, this 98-year-old guy, at like 21 years old. He'd already freshly killed a bunch of people in Ukraine, in the SS. This photograph, it's him. It's definitely him. And people are beginning to come to grips with this realization that in my opinion, the United States, to a greater extent than the Soviet Union, a much, much larger extent than that then Soviet Union, embraced fascists from Germany and Ukraine, and even through the efforts of the OSS and the CIA, helped the Pope at that time, funneled hundreds of thousands of Nazi fascists into South America, into Canada, and into the United States.
But, Mike, this isn't news. We've known this for 40 years.
No. Most Americans do not know. For instance,
well, they may not know it. I've known it. You know, I mean, if you want to know it, you know it. You know.
I think it's absolutely provable now that there, I mean, and it, there's no, you can name the geographic locations where they came, how they got in. It's an outstanding book. It's not a conspiracy book. It's called.
Okay.
My point
what's
is.
What's the point, though? What's your point?
History is slapping people in the face, and they're starting to wake up, I think. And I think the anti-war.
Well, listen, I think Ray McGovern's idea, I don't know what he's up to, but I think dialogue is the key word, and we're not having it right now. That's the problem.
Yeah, we're not having it with Russia.
Well, you can't have one-way dialogue with somebody who insists on, you know, bombing people in Ukraine. You just can't have a dialogue with a person like that. He thinks he can outweigh the United States. He can keep bringing death and destruction to Ukraine, you know, death and destruction to little Russian young men, and he doesn't give a shit about that. And he can keep doing that, he claims, he thinks, longer than the United States can support Ukraine. That's, to me, that's the issue right now. You can't get Vladimir Putin to negotiate or to dialogue in any way because he thinks he can win this by simple brutality and he doesn't have to answer to any moral, you know, code or anything. He doesn't have to answer to anything. And, he can just say, I want us to be glorious like when we were glorious back in the Stalin days. And, of course, Stalin, I think, is credited with killing more people than Hitler. All those people in Ukraine, for Christ's sakes, who were forcibly starved in Russia's wheat basket during those periods. You know, this is their breadbasket, and the people were starved by the millions there. Terrible, terrible stuff that the Russians, Stalin, the Russians did then. What about that? You know, I mean, horrible.
I think I read large portions of the book by I think his name's Tim Snyder, and it's horrible, but and I think he's got large parts of his narrative historically correct in terms of some of the numbers, but I don't even think he says that the Soviets killed more people than the Germans. I think the Ukrainians
I'm not saying that's gospel truth, but I have heard people declare that. They may be full of you know what. I don't know.
Yeah. And, you know, a sizable number.
You know, the killing of the Jews was not one-sided. Stalin killed a hell of a lot of people, in the millions.
Well, listen, there was 27 million Russian soldiers dead going to the Reichstag in Berlin, okay, in 1945. That 27 million counts, and a large number of them were Ukrainian communists. Okay, now no matter, or at least soldiers in the Ukrainian Red Army, members of the firmly believe that figure is very close. Now, some people say it was 21 million. In any event, it was such an astronomical number of people to die to push back the fact that I think it supersedes a lot of this. And I think that's why it's so alarming to see, they're not ghosts, but to see Zelensky and the Azov Brigade, which is now been integrated into the Ukrainian army, and that the Socialist Party of Ukraine is outlawed and the Communist Party of Ukraine is outlawed and cannot be part of a legal political party to run an election.
Ideological war with a country that invaded them, you know. I mean,
Russia, well,
you know, the Communist Party linked with Russia is their enemy.
Banning Russia is not a communist or even attempts to be a communist country anymore. Doesn't even pretend it.
Well, there you go. There you go. Of course, that's.
But I mean,
there's so many circling backs here. It's absurd. Yeah.
Why is Zelensky, outlawing these parties with the support of the Ukrainian government? And people like Rachel Maddow barely touches on this subject. Members of the Democratic Party shut their mouths in criticizing Biden for this military aid that is being sent. This is very frustrating for me because I'm watching the isolationist libertarians, conservatives primarily take the helm of any anti-war movement. And here's where
this is what I've been talking about for two goddamn years. I agree with this.
Let me give one last comment. We got 15 minutes. Let me give this one last. Now, I think, I always suspected, you tell me, show me a billionaire-supported libertarian movement, like that I'd seen in Kansas through Charles Koch and the Koch family and other many, many conservative billionaires, okay? I've seen these things go this way and before, and the American public is not ready for a red Caesar who will start a real war with Mexico as the president of Mexico, AMLO.
Well, that's what Ron DeSantis said in the last debate. He almost declared war on Mexico.
I firmly believe that we'll send U.S. troops in some form or manner into armed military hostilities with the government of Mexico on the south border. I'll tell you what, I really think that's the curveball that many of our right-wing libertarian.
I agree 100%. I've said this as the same exact thing in different terms, but yes, I agree 100%. A red Caesar, a red state Caesar, the idea. I mean, Trump has made it quite clear. I mean, making veiled references that General Milley should be executed for treason and all this kind of stuff. This guy is a running death machine. He is so desperate that he is toying with violence in a way that, we've never seen in this country, I don't think. I mean, obviously we had KKK and all that, but they were always, a sort of, insurrectional kind of elements that weren't supported by or didn't claim to have somebody in the White House that was overtly doing this stuff. Again, watching this Visconti movie, The Damned, which in this rich family's life at the point of the Reichstag fire, where the Nazis and Hitler really got to the traction, because they apparently said it themselves. He was your red Caesar at the time.
The irony was the Nazi Party caught on with the anti-communism. They blamed it on a young communist who was from, he wasn't even.
Of course they did. That was in the movie. Yeah, right.
Communist. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, but the point is, I don't know what all of this resurrecting things in the past and gotcha stuff, mm-hmm. and bad guys, all this stuff. But what is the issue? The issue is, does the United States continue to support the Ukrainian war effort vis-a-vis Vladimir Putin's Russia, or do we stop it and therefore, make Ukraine more and more vulnerable until eventually, Putin will get what he wants and he will, roll over the place. And, I don't know, like Hawley. And I've talked about this crossover between left and right for going on 2 years now. I've had arguments with people, Best for Peace. I've had arguments with Dave Lindorf. I see it. I use the abstract example of Jose Ortega Gasset, a Spanish philosopher who talked about the line of left and right, we could call it blue and red state America, but between left, political left and literal right, with the center being the center, is not a straight line. It is a circle in which the snake bites its tail, and where the snake bites its tail is the extreme right and the extreme left, both of them opposed to the centrist quote, deep state as the boogeyman. Biden, the deep state, all this kind of stuff. We've been, you know, and the left have been boogeyman in the deep state for what? Decades. Suddenly the right, this libertarian right, decided, well, we're a populist far-right element, so we hate the deep state too. And so, yes, there is this crossover and interweaving and, you know, strange bedfellow sympathies between the far-right populist movements and the far-left populist movements. And the far-left populist movements are feeling very much like losers these days. And as I talk about in my writing, as an abstract discussion of, you know, what you pursue, are you pursuing truth or are you pursuing power? Well, the problem is that the left feels powerless. The radical far left feels, you know, things have passed them by. They're losers. They're not, you know, we've obviously lost on the war front. You know, anti-war movement is defunct. And so what is happening on the left, the extreme left, is it does not have any power anymore. Nobody listens to it. We, you know, the right, the populist right, wants to own liberals. It wants to make them cry again, you know. And so the left is without power. So they look over at the far right, you know, libertarians, and they say, my God, these guys are feared. These guys have power. So, you know, there's an inclination to say, well, shit, they have power. And they're saying this, which we agree with. They hate the deep state, you know. And so suddenly these anti-war people, you know, well, fuck truth. I'm going to go with the power. And so there is this affinity with the left looking at Pauly and people like that, I suppose. And, I mean, it's all very vague now, but the point is, with the coming election, it's going to be the political football. Ukraine is the political football now. And you're going to see this crossover on the populist right and the populist left. I mean, I've seen it already. I know my friends are in it. And, you know, that's what Tucker Carlson's job was, to recruit radical left people to this crazy, you know, MAGA thing. You know, he got Tulsi Gabbard, turned her. He turned Glenn Greenwald and other people. So it's happening. You know, what you suggested, I agree with. But I don't know what to do about it. I mean, I'm sitting here. I don't know what to do about it. I mean, if I'm a truth teller and seeking the truth, I don't have any power. I can say all this all I want, you know. And so the problem is that, you know, anti-war people who don't feel they have any power look at people on the libertarian right and they go, wow, maybe, you know, it's like the American conservative with Patrick Buchanan and Norman Mailer back in, you know, during the Iraq War. You know, you realize you woke up in the morning and you say, fuck, I'm ideologically, politically in bed with Patrick Buchanan. How did this happen? You know, remember that period?
Yeah.
And so we're, you know, this is how strange bedfellows work. And boy, there's a lot of strange bedfellows going to be going on in 2024. It's a whole new ball game. You know, all sides are going to be reevaluated and, you know, trying to make sense out of it. We're going to have discussions like we've been having for an hour here. Yeah, trying to figure all this stuff out. Right?
Yeah, well, I'm just alarmed. I'm just alarmed at the it started off with the an SS member getting two standing ovations in Parliament to make me sit back and go, well, I heard about the Azov. I didn't
well,
realize.
Well, I mean, I find it distasteful having an SS veteran getting applause. You know what?
I just thought, well, that's some neo-Nazi's granddad out there.
Exactly.
There's probably some Ukrainian kid looking on TV and going, that looks like granddad. I heard he left
Canada.
Or
it may be some radical lefty's granddad. We don't know. Look at me.
God,
I'm the son of a bigoted right-wing guy, and I'm a radical lefty. You know?
Hey,
we react. We flip,
hey,
you know.
In 5 minutes, I got to get this. my great grandfather was a member of the Ku Klux Klan on my dad's side. Now, how do I know that? Because his daughter, I really only met the guy. I only remember meeting him. I guess when I was a baby, I met him when I was an infant.
You never met him with his sheet on, huh?
Yeah, I never met him with his sheet on, and I don't remember. But, you know, like 10, 15 years later, as I was growing up around his daughter told me that. And I said, oh, my, are you serious? And I said, what did you do? And she, now, this woman, this old woman, who's gone now, she was a dye-in-the-wool socialist, but you never heard her use that word or any ism. She never used an ism of any kind. But she told me about John Lewis and the United Mine Workers, the strike. She was a young woman when all those were going on, and in mid-60s and early in the late 60s, she opened up and told me about the farmers' unions up in Iowa and Nebraska filling the ditches with cow's milk in protest of being robbed over the prices of milk.
Well, you know, it's people like that who, you know, like my mother told me, the middle son who was having trouble with his father, you know, and the other two kids seemed to be fine with the old man. She took me under her wing, and she chose to tell me about 1937, my father unfurling a Nazi banner in Wesleyan, and FDR canceling a speech because of my dear old dad. Now, I told my brother about that, the lawyer, and he says, no, that can't be true. Hey, Dick, my mother, your mother told me, I remember sitting in the kitchen table, she told me this, you know. Well, our father wasn't a Nazi. I didn't say he was a Nazi. I said he was a prank, but he had a flag. I told this to a Jewish friend at lunch.
Yeah, how would he get a flag like that in 37?
I don't know. Well, the Nazis were a big deal in 1937.
Yeah,
look, you read about Smedley Butler, you know, all that stuff. 1937, you know, they had huge meetings in New York with swastikas and all this stuff.
But
let me tell you this. I told this Jewish guy at lunch last week, you know, this story. And I said, but my dad, you know, my dad wasn't a Nazi. And he looked at me and he says, well, like you just said, he had the banner. I wouldn't be so sure he wasn't a Nazi, you know. I'm going like, wait a minute, you know. You know, okay, what, you know, identity, what makes one a Nazi? Do you have to, like, be a card carrier, or you get a banner, and you're an arrogant undergraduate provocative kid, and you think this is funny and cool, and, you know, fuck the Jews. And my father was an anti-Semite, alas. I hate to say that.
That just sounds like a Nazi, John.
And although one of his closest friends was a Jew who he worked with, you know, go figure, you know. Life is complicated, you know. And the old man was a grand bullshitter, I got to say. But, you know, so where all this stuff settles out in 2023. Like my brother has got a campaign for me not to research this thing in Westland, which I want to do. And he's said the most rude thing he's ever said. I don't give a shit, John. I just don't give a shit.
Well, there.
Fuck you. You know, I do give a shit for some reason.
Well, look,
but he makes me feel like I'm soiling the family by researching this.
Well, let me. I got a minute. We got to go. But I want to throw this in. And my grandmother.
Okay.
The KKK daddy's daughter.
Right.
Tells me
in the
mid-60s, as the civil rights struggles exploding on black and white TV with Walter Cronkite. She tells me, she says, I was married and I walked on the strike lines at the ship work in California when the longshoremen went on strike during World War II. I'm going to give that to people to think about the power of workers and money.
Let's hear for the Union now.
Y'all good?
Hey, Mike Goodell, you're the man.